Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to Inner Spark Radio, a weekly show in which I talk with experts about ways to ignite the spark within. I'm your host, Lena Gazurian, and you can learn more about our upcoming shows as well as listen to archive shows at innersparkradio.com, on Blog Talk Radio, on Facebook, and also on iTunes. And I am really excited to talk with today's guest on the topic of sacred dreams. Her name is Dr. Lori Jones Swick, and she holds a PhD in philosophy and religion with a concentration in women's spirituality from California Institute of Integral Studies. And she's earned a master's degree in theology from the University of Notre Dame with distinct honors and a bachelor's degree in religion and writing from St. Edward's University with valedictory honors. She's also the author of two books, Comfort and Mirth and Dreaming the Sacred Art. Aside from writing and instructing retreats and seminars, she is an adjunct professor in religion and mythology at St. Edward's University in Austin. She's also a published poet and an award-winning essayist. And you can learn more about Dr. Swick at loriswick.com. That's Lori with an I. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm really happy to have you here. It's going to be an interesting show. Before we launch into the questions, I guess I just wanted to say what I think I had mentioned this to you when we spoke briefly. Just say to the people listening about your book that your book is, I see it, it's not a fast food book. It's really a book to take one's time with and savor little by little, to take things in and practice the techniques, and it's just such a nice blend of history and practicality and psychology and mythology. So I just wanted to give my thumbs up for your book. I think it's really great.
Thank you. I appreciate you saying that too, because I actually, when I teach the seminars on the book, I like to separate it into four different sessions, because there's four different actually techniques of Dreaming the Sacred Heart, the way the book is structured. And it really helps to be able to really digest one at a time and have time to think and practice before going forward. So I do appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, oh, good. Well, thanks. So, all right, let's get right into it then. So I'd love to know, and I'd love for you to share with everyone, what personally drew you to working with sacred dreams?
I have been a sacred dreamer most of my life. I started having, and I explain this in the book, I started having very, very vivid dreams when I was about 13 years old, after the first time that I had surgery. And I was, you know, of course, in bed recovering for a long time and sleeping a lot more than usual. And I started to realize that I was a lucid dreamer. And I realized that I was dreaming, and I would get very, very strong sensations, and I would, knowing that I was dreaming, I would, and of course at the time not knowing what was going on, I would get very scared, and it would turn into a night terror very quickly because I couldn't wake up. And as I got older, I learned to control it and to realize that I was safe in my dream and to follow it where it would go, and just always being of sacred spiritual nature, I guess, and I think most spiritual people are just automatically spiritual dreamers too. I started to follow the sacred elements in my dream and learn a lot about myself and about my creative aspects of dreaming, which I've always been a creative person too. And so that's kind of how it developed for me. And as I grew up, my interest in it definitely grew with me. And in doing research, I found that I was not unique in this, that a lot of people start having their dreams when they're young, if they're sacred dreamers and especially lucid dreamers, after a time of having some sort of sickness, or when they're, you know, have a prolonged time of sleeping more than waking life, and get in touch with it. And like in the ancient, in a lot of the indigenous traditions, the shamans from the culture would be somebody who healed themselves through dreams. So this is, I guess, sort of symptomatic of how lucid and sacred dreaming get started. And it was how it started for me.
And that's how it started. And I was going to maybe ask you about lucid dreaming a bit later on. Do you think we would get into that later? Or since you brought it up, do you want to, what do you think?
No.
Do you want to talk
about it?
We'll
just follow the flow that you
follow
have
the flow, okay. All right. So then you write that what a sacred or a mystical dream is, it varies according to what's culturally or personally considered sacred. So in that way, how do you define a sacred dream? And also, are you using mythical and sacred interchangeably?
Okay. In a way, yes. Yes, I guess I am. What I teach a lot of throughout the years, I've taught a lot of world religions. And this book is very based, in fact, I think in most bookstores, it's actually, you'll find it in the world religion department before you'll find it in the dream department, because it draws on a lot of the world religions. So, of course, what people think of as sacred changes, as you say, not only from culture, but individually. I mean, even within the same religious tradition, what people experience as being sacred is very, very different. Sacred can, for some people, mean it has to do with the divine, whether it be, you know, God or Jesus Christ in the Christian culture, or being a god or goddess in the Hindu culture. But a lot of people have very strong sensations of the sacred, especially in dreams of being like pure energy, or especially pure light dreams that are perceived as sacred are very, very common. So in essence, and it's you know, of course, what is sacred is hard to talk about because it's ineffable, if you will, and it's different from person to person. But I'm talking about dreams in which the dreamer perceives that they have experienced something that is of sacred or religious or spiritual nature to them, however they conceive of that. And sometimes it can be more of a feeling than an actual vision in a dream.
Mm-hmm.
Now, to link that to mythology, I also teach mythology, and a lot of my studies, my dissertation is centered on the mythological symbolism of religion. And I use the term myth, as most anthropologists and religious scholars do today, and that is strictly the story that a religion is based on. Because what happens in mythology is sort of a cultural expression of what happens to an individual while they are dreaming. Both of them are driven by what psychologist Carl Jung called undirected thought. In other words, instead of thinking in words like we often do in our waking life, those of us who live in literate societies, we're thinking from that part of our brains like ancient people did, where you're just schematic clusters of images or thoughts, and it's driven by symbol, both of them. Mythology is definitely a system of symbols, and dreams are definitely systems of symbols. So what happens in a sacred dream is spirituality that's encoded in the symbols, much like myth is. Does that make sense?
It makes sense. And mystical as well, as that's what I was wondering. Is that interchangeable with sacred in your?
Yes, I did. I the reason that I introduced the concept of being mystical is because I drew on a really interesting study that was done by a religious writer of dreams named Kelly Bulkeley, and he did a survey of people who had sacred dreams, and he referred to them as mystical dreams. So in order to speak directly to his work and integrate it in mine, I introduced the concept that what we're talking about here can be considered a mystical dream. Mystical being, yeah, and to my way of thinking, mysticism implies an immediate experience of the divine, or that which one considers to be most sacred. So yes, I am using interchangeable for that reason.
Okay, no, that's a good explanation. Thank you.
Sure.
And then what would you say is the purpose for engaging in dream work? What do you say?
Well, there are a number of purposes. I just don't even know where to start. Mostly because what drives dreams, and mythology, if you will, but speaking specifically about dreams, is that, and to use again, to borrow on Carl Jung's work with the psyche, so much of what we experience in life, you know, there's probably a very, very fine percentage of it that we can cognitively deal with, the input, you know, that we, just what I see, what I look at, what I feel, you know, what's going on around me all the time. The rest of it goes into our deep consciousness. It doesn't disappear, you know. Mm-hmm. Everything that we encounter, it affects us. It goes somewhere in our psyche. Some things we just, you know, we just go straight to our unconscious because we don't have the time or the energy or don't even need to deal with it. Other things we repress on purpose because for one reason or another we don't want to face it and think about it. But that energy doesn't die. And what happens is when we go through the different stages of the sleep cycle and our cognitive brain gets totally relaxed, is that things that are in our subconscious that feel like they need to, that our consciousness needs to deal with, you know, in other words, somewhere in the back of our brains, we're not totally resolved on it, will keep representing itself to the consciousness through dreams. And that's why some people have recurring dreams, or a lot of times if you really research and write down your dreams, you'll see that even though the symbols may change, you'll see a lot of similar symbol structures that keep representing themselves until our consciousness deals with it. So from that standpoint, not only through dreams can we psychologically learn an awful lot about ourselves, and especially for spiritual dreamers, can we learn a lot about our relationship with ourselves as spiritual people, our relationship with that which we perceive as sacred. A lot of that can be totally and completely fully appreciated through dreams. Again, a lot of people use dreams in a lot of cultures, you know, in Eastern cultures much more than the West, as a means of healing of the self. Because if you can really get into that and see what's going on, like even if you're physically hurt, sometimes it will present itself to you in a dream if you know how to deal with it before your body will show the symptoms and you'll realize it. And historically that's happened many times. So you know, for healing, for self-growth, for personal fulfillment, and to enrich your spiritual life are just some of the reasons that it's really important to pay attention to what's going on in our dreams, especially those, I think, which we perceive as being sacred to some extent.
Yeah, it sure covers just about everything, doesn't it? I mean, there's no reason not to engage in dream work, or especially the sacred dream work, but that's, yeah. That, and you brought up the healing. I think we'll come to that in a little bit, because I wanted to move into the piece that you talk about, where you say it's crucial in developing a fruitful practice, is how wide the line is between our waking and sleeping consciousness. So will you tell us what is the relationship between our waking sacred thoughts or our waking visions or experiences and our sleeping sacred dreams?
Okay.
Why is that crucial?
I want to say that the line is different for different people in different cultures. Of course, in a lot of shamanic communities or indigenous communities and a lot of the Eastern communities that have really, really developed their dream work, there is no line. And even in biblical, you know, the way they talk about prophecies and dreams almost interchangeably leads us to believe, like in the ancient world, you know, waking visions and nighttime dreaming are of the same nature. And especially in the Tibetan bone tradition, you know, the concept there is that none of it's real. You know, the real essence of it isn't in either one, but in dreams you can at least explore the real essence and practice for what will be. So in our Western culture, the one that I've been raised in, and most of us, there's very little interface between, you know, what we experience during the day and what we experience at night in their dreams, to the extent that an overwhelming number of people that I talk to, when they find out I wrote a book about dreaming, will flatly tell me, I don't dream. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that's impossible. Yeah. Right. Modern science has proven beyond a doubt that not only do we dream, but if you sleep a 7 to 8 hour night, you know, you're going to dream, you know, probably 4 or 5 different times. You know, we dream in cycles. So we all dream. And I'm straying here, and I probably got away from the original question. So you can ground me, if you will.
Sure, that's okay. I was wondering, you were saying that in order to develop a fruitful practice, we would do well to close the gap, I guess, between our waking and sleeping. Yeah.
Yeah, and if those who really practice sacred dreaming according to the methods, and each chapter in the book does have a step-by-step method, what will happen is that the gap will close by itself. And there's little consciousness between dream life and waking life, especially for lucid dreamers. The reality that's presented in that is an extension. And, of course, because dreams and our waking consciousness, it's all coming out of the same psyche, right? It's all coming out of your consciousness, out of your mind, if you will. So what happens is that in the West we have sort of, our cognitive brain is one thing, and what happens in our deep consciousness in our dreams is totally another. But in reality, when you start becoming of your dreams and when you start being able to relate or connect what's going on in your consciousness between what's going on in your consciousness, that line starts to disappear. In fact, one of the best ways to incubate, if you will, or cultivate the ability to have sacred lucid dreams, you know, in other words, to be aware while you're dreaming that you're dreaming and control it, is to many times during the day, you know, tell yourself or ask yourself, is this a dream? And if you do it and you start, you develop the practice of dreaming lucidly and being aware in your dreams, then the awareness of who you are and what you are, and especially within your spiritual life, starts to close the gap of your consciousness of what happens during the day and what happens during your dreaming. And I'm including not just visions here during the day, because, I mean, that indicates a sort of state of a trance, which is certainly very possible and a lot of people do with regularity to different. But just in your waking life while you're driving down the street or walking in a park, you know, if you can relate that to your dream life, both of them become richer and fuller.
So it's just to say, just to ask yourself periodically from during the day, am I awake? Am I asleep? Or is this a dream? Or am I dreaming?
Yeah. And even just to, you know, just affirm, say this is a dream. And like I mentioned in the book, I like to say, you know, because I do find dreaming of the spiritual nature so fulfilling. As during the day, I'll just, especially if I see something beautiful, I'll say, this is a dream. This is a beautiful, wonderful dream. And then if you do that, you will continue to do that while you are dreaming. Mm-hmm. And then you will realize during your dream you are dreaming, and that is the best way. And also if you do that, you can affirm that you can kind of steer yourself toward a good dream and not a nightmare, you know, or something that will frighten you. Because until you get used to lucid dreaming, it can be quite scary at first, you know, to realize that you're asleep. Because when you, and I'm skipping ahead to lucid dreaming, and I'm
no,
sorry.
No, that's fine. It seems to want to be here.
when you're sleeping, and, you know, most of these dreams happen in REM stages of sleep. And what happens is that your brain automatically, your nervous system automatically shuts down your muscles while you're sleeping, simply because if it didn't, you would act out your dreams, you know, and you could hurt yourself or someone else. So when you realize you're lucidly dreaming and you try to move your body and you can't, it can be frightening unless you know what's going on and you can control it. And work then not with your physical body, but with, you know, what modern thinkers, psychologists call the subtle body or the dream body, or, you know, in spiritual speaking, this could be the concept of one spirit or soul, you know, and being able to move it around and go pretty much where you want and do what you want. But that's kind of the process of, you know, what can happen when you're first experimenting with lucid sacred dreaming. And again, the gap between, especially through lucid dreaming, the gap between your dream life and your real life, the line between it can narrow and thin and really kind of go away when you develop, especially what I call like a feedback system of working with your dreams and waking life, expressing it in art. And, mm-hmm. and because what will happen, stop me anytime if I'm rambling, but I'm enjoying myself.
Go, please. Go right ahead.
In my chapter about creating art, like after you have a dream or dream symbols, if you want to work with it, and you, you know, write a poem about it or take the time to, you know, especially a sacred symbol or something, and I speak about one particularly in the book to kind of talk about the different stages, or paint a picture. Or once you do that, what happens is a reality in your waking life enriches it. And then if you take that and think about it as you're going back to sleep and do a dream intention, then your dreams will carry it even further into what's going on. So I mean, the two, your waking life work, you know, with your dream symbols, and then taking it back into your dream and dreaming it about again, taking it back in your waking life and writing about it, journaling about it, working with it again. If you can keep this up, just amazing things can happen. You can learn amazing things about yourself. It can be just really an incredibly satisfying experience, and a tremendous amount of the world's great arts were first conceived in dreams or the product of dreams. I'm going to stop for a while.
No, it doesn't surprise me. Well, there's so many things that came out of that. I'm not sure which way to go now. I guess, well, one thing I'd like to ask, you know, so for those who are listening, when you were saying in the lucid dream, if you come up with a sacred symbol or something, how would somebody kind of decipher what that might be in their, or is it very obvious, you know, is it something, what
no,
does it
usually,
elicit something?
For some dreamers, it could be more than often it is not, because as I said, almost everything is encoded in symbolism, which of course is metaphor, and our consciousness are really funny that way. I mean, just in ways you wouldn't think. You know, they can encode things in symbol that unless you really work with it, you can't figure it out. Now, I do have a method that I derived, and of course I derived it in working with mythology and honed it to work with dream symbolism. But I want to back up and talk a little bit about basic dream symbols. To find, again, dreams are fraught with symbols. I mean, fraught with them. But if there's a certain symbol that keeps popping up in a certain dream that you perceive as sacred, as I said before, for a lot of people this could be a beam or just a presence of light. It can be a bird, you know, that seems to have be charged with some sort of sacred message that you can't decipher. It could be anything. You know, it could be mm-hmm. the ocean. It could be a feeling. But if there's something that you've noticed a lot in your dreams through journaling or just remembering, that's a good place to start. So if you can draw a symbol from your dreams you think is sacred, that's a good symbol to start with. But in order to unpack what's going on in each particular symbol, first of all, as I said, go through your dreams. If you have a certain dream that you perceived as being sacred, but you don't know exactly why and no symbol stands out, do what an anthropologist by the name of Clifford Hertz calls a thick description. Take whatever you can remember and write down every detail, whether it seems significant or not. Get it all out there. And all of a sudden you'll see certain symbols will start to come out of it that speak to you. Like, for example, say there was a bird, a kind of bird that seemed really important in your dream. Say it's a peacock, okay?
Okay.
So then you take the actual symbol, the next thing to do, and ask yourself, okay, for one of the first things that will impact our dreams, of course, as everybody knows, is we'll dream about things that happened in the last day or two, you know? Ask yourself if something happened recently that might remind you of a peacock. And, you know, you might get a list of things. And then ask yourself throughout your whole life, if you take the symbol of the peacock out of the context of dream and say, what do I associate with peacocks? Beauty? They have, you know, all over their feathers, it looks like they have 1,000 eyes that can have, you know, eyes and dreams can have to do with seeing, whether it be physical or, you know, like, aha, now I get it, you know. I mean, there could be any number of things. The color, the luster, you know, the way they seem to change color. They're so big, the way they walk. You know, it could just be anything depending on who you are. Could be their beady eyes scared you once. It could be you saw them in a zoo and, you know, it really affected you in a different way. And then, you know, write down what that is specifically that peacock might have meant to you throughout your life, you know, what you associate that with otherwise, in other words, what it symbolizes to you personally. Then what really interesting things will happen. Again, Carl Jung, working on Freud, and a lot of depth psychologists, I'll say, have noticed that a lot of times what we dream in dreams, even though we personally might not have associations with, in our deep ancestry going back, you know, to thousands of years ago may still affect our consciousness. And Jung calls this archaic remnants. So to make a long story short, get a dream symbolism book or just a symbolism book and look up what culturally peacocks meant. And there, you know, you might have an aha moment where, you know, peacocks meant something in the grand scheme of things culturally that you never even thought about, that all of a sudden really speaks to you about what's going on in the dream. So you take all of these things and research them in this way, and things will start popping out about what that peacock meant and what it was doing in your dream and what it was trying to say to you. And then you take these things and you ask yourself, like, what is the value I associate that with? Does the peacock scare me? Am I trying to deal with my fright? Do I feel like, because of all the eyes on it, that people are looking at me and watching me, or somebody's invading my privacy? It could be any number of things. But then, and the reason it's so introspective and each individual has to do it, because it all has to do with how things are associated within each individual psyche, of course, except for the archaic remnants, which really can work. So you put all these things together, and all of a sudden, the deeper inner meaning of these dreams and what it's trying to tell you will a lot of times just astonish you, just astonish you. And to take it one step further, like Stephen Eisenstadt says, and he did a really interesting series of tapes called Dream Tending, and he says, just very simply, too, if something like a peacock, you know, or a person or a sacred presence appears in a dream and you don't know what it is, in your lucidity, if you can train yourself to dream lucidly, then you can just ask it, what do you want? Why are you here? And many times in dreams, it will just tell you. there's just a lot of ways you can work with it. But I hope I answered your question.
You did. No, you did, actually. And then back to lucid dreams just for a second, too. I guess I just want to be clear to say, are you saying that to get to the lucid state is the ideal state of dreaming, quote unquote? Is that what we're kind of working towards?
Especially for sacred dreaming, and I should say too, really, to get the full aspects, to get the full benefits of dream healing, being able to heal from dreams, of being able to really know yourself in dreams, to understand what dreams are trying to tell you, it is really good to be able to train yourself to be lucid. And the good news is that most people can, you know, with practice, usually within a fairly short amount of time, if you keep at it, train themselves to dream lucidly. Just simply because you can interact with whatever's going on in the dream, you can train yourself to do that. And just solve a lot of the issues within the dream. Now, the question is, how active should you be in a dream? You know, are you ruining the effect of the dream and what it's trying to tell you if within the course of the dream you take off and fly before, you know, whatever's trying to talk to you has said what it has to say? And there's been a lot of debate about that. Stephen LeBerge in the West was the scientist. He's not, sacred dreaming is not his thing, but he's done the most scientific research and probably written the most and been the real pioneer of lucid dreaming from a psychological standpoint. And he says, and in the Tibetan bone tradition, which is very spiritually based, lucid dreaming, those are probably the two largest sources for sacred dreaming, for lucid dreaming that we have. In the bone tradition, I mean, they're just all for totally manipulating your dreams, flying, multiplying yourself. I mean, it's just incredible what in the Tibetan yoga of dreams and sleep. It's a very interesting short read, but it's very fun. But and then there's others who say, well, you know, by manipulating your dreams too much, you're ruining the fact. And that's something to, if you're lucid in a dream, ask yourself if it's a sacred dream, if there's a sacred presence. Do you feel like it wants you to come near? Then you should go near. Do you feel like you shouldn't? Then you shouldn't. You know, I think when you can think reflexively from within the narrative of the dream while you're in the story, obviously you're going to get more out of it than if you wait till you wake up and remember what little pieces of it you can, you know, that you can recall and work with that.
Right. So you already, one thing you told us was to practice in our waking life by questioning or saying, I am dreaming, or am I, oh, I'm saying it wrong now. I was saying it to myself for a while, but I'm in a dream now, or this is a beautiful dream, as we're awake, right?
Right,
to sort of narrow the gap, and then I guess to have the intention to be lucid in dreams is another thing. But is there anything else you can share that you think is helpful to help us be more lucid in our dreams?
Well, in the book, again, it depends on the individual. In my actual chapter on lucid dreaming, I talk about several different ways that you can use to try to become more lucid. But the most productive way, and actually in the first chapter of the book, I talk about incubating dreams. In other words, cultivating the kind of dream you want to have. And the most universal way of, and the most effective way of doing that is doing what's commonly called setting a dream intention. Now, throughout history, and I talk about in the book how different cultures throughout history and different religious cultures have gone about incubating dreams, and I talk about them separately, but then when you go back and hold them up side by side, there's a lot of the common symbols, if you will, or elements or rituals that seem to show up in almost all dreams. One of them is purification, the concept of taking a bath or soaking or, you know, going to a sauna or some kind of purification. In, you know, some cultures you wear certain white clothes and that sort of thing. But then in almost all of them also, it's really interesting, they used fire in some way, lit candles, lit lamps. But it was universal. You know, there's the concept of, And there's a lot of good symbolic meanings for this. And again, as I said, it's very, very common for people to experience the sacred in the form of bright, pure light in dreams. So that could be just, you know, an unconscious expression of that. But the most universal means of telling yourself you're going to have a dream or a sacred dream and that you're going to be lucid in your dream is set the dream intention. Do whatever pre-sleep rituals work, and I talk about in the first chapter, but then before you go to sleep, you know, write it down if you want, put it on your pillow, but just start telling yourself as you breathe, and I do a real simple, you know, means of meditation before you go to sleep, and many people, of course, have their own techniques for this, but as you do that, and as you tell yourself what your dream intention is, and you design your own, you know, but first of all, it's very good if you wanted to specifically to know that you're dreaming, you know, that you're having a lucid dream, and to invite the sacred to enter your dreams. You can say something like, before you go to bed, breathe, you know, get to that place and say, tonight when I dream, I will know that I'm dreaming, and hopefully I will experience the sacred, or any manifestation of that, and I've developed that more in the actual book. But if you say that over and over, what it will do is it can be a bridge between your waking state through that hypnagogic state between, you know, that sort of dusky, you know, liminal world between waking and sleeping, and it will carry you through that into your sleep. Or if not, it will just stay in your consciousness in such a place that it will help your unconsciousness that when you eventually start dreaming, you know, it will go, hey, this is, you know, and it will recognize that as a continuation of what you were doing when you did your intention, and you're more likely to realize it. Another thing to do, and the dream symbol is pervasive. If you have a sacred dream symbol you really want to work with, really focus on it and think about it as you're going to sleep. Because the dream world is symbolic, you can literally follow with practice a dream symbol mm-hmm. from your waking consciousness through the hypnagogic state and into your dream consciousness. It takes practice, but it can be done. It's been documented often throughout history. I mean, I have gotten so that I can do it. Not all the time. Dreams are capricious. You know, you're dealing with different areas of your psyche and different depths, you know, of information in different places in your psyche. And you know, it's, you know, I'm not even beginning to say you can control it all the time, because that would not be true and it wouldn't be nearly as fun. But you really can. You really can train yourself to do that. And as I say in each chapter, because the editor asked me to, I did at the back of the chapter, like in chapter one, I talk about cultivating the dream. Chapter two, the thin line between waking and consciousness. I think chapter four was lucid dreaming. But at the end of each chapter, I do a step-by-step, here's how you practice doing this particular technique.
And yeah, which is wonderful.
With continuation, it works.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No. I'm gonna take a break.
Yeah. No. That was gonna say. Yeah. It's great because it's, again, like I said in the beginning too. It's like you really just you break it down and then you just kind of savor it, and you work with each piece like the lucid dreaming or the pre-sleep rituals, and you know it's a very guided how-to hands-on. Process. So, yeah, because clearly there's so much we can't cover in this one interview, but so that people know that there's so much in there that you'll guide them through, you know, step by step. But you did give us some good, you did give us some good ideas for ways to approach it, even if we don't, if, you know, they don't have your book, at least to start thinking about it. And the pre-sleep ritual, like, whether it's a bath or a shower or a massage or lighting a candle or whatever, that is something that we should do every night, right? I mean, mm-hmm. that's the ritual, is right before sleep to do that, to sort of.
Yeah, I mean, it conditions your psyche to go, okay, now I'm getting ready to dream, you know. And it can be different things for different people, and I discuss that. But by doing that and developing your own pre-sleep ritual, you can condition yourself to dream, have sacred dreams, and even to have sacred lucid dreams. So the more you do it, I mean, and of course, practically speaking, you know, if you did all of this, and especially we didn't talk much about journaling, but that's really important too. I mean, you could spend your whole life doing nothing else, yeah, you know, because
right.
It really gets interesting. It can be very intricate. And as I said, dreams are fraught with symbols. And if you tried to work with each one, you could get so immersed in it. So, you know, you have to weigh that, you know, and pace yourself. But if you are trying to incubate sacred dreams, or if there's a certain aspect of it you're working on right then, it is really good if you can to repeat it every night, because the more you do it, the more you're likely to train yourself to be able to dream in a sacred manner and realize you're doing it while you dream. And you can also condition yourself to remember your dreams when you wake up better, and I talk about that in a separate chapter. But yeah, practice, you know, the more you practice, the more likely it is that'll happen. And
I want to make sure that we cover healing. So there was something you wrote about that I was definitely intrigued by. I wanted to ask you about this, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this correctly or not, but you write about the Asclepian, is that how you say it? Healing dream temples?
Yes,
I guess, or Edward Tick writes about that. Did I say that right?
I believe so, yeah.
Asclepian, okay. So, and you said, or he thinks, and maybe you think, that we would do well to revive this model of the healing dream temple. So my question is, why, and this is for healing, psychological, physical, spiritual, why and how exactly did those temples work? Did people sleep there?
Oh, yeah. Now, Edward Tick, he's the one who actually we have to credit him with having actually said that. Okay. And I just quoted him on that. I think that as a model, what he is saying and what I totally agree with is that back in the ancient, you know, Greco-Roman world where these temples were huge, I mean, some of them were tremendous, and really which probably borrowed originally on some of the Egyptian dream temples too, which was probably a real standard for that. But what I agree with Edward Tick on is that we can learn a lot from taking that model and taking it as seriously as they did, and they totally believed that it could heal them. And the way the temple would work is that they had huge grounds. The one especially, I think, at I'm trying to remember where it was, and I can't offhand, was just tremendous. But there were grounds. People would come to them from all over and spend a lot of time there, especially if they felt like they needed healing, whether it be physical, emotional, mental. But it was very, very ritual-driven. There were snakes wandering freely about because, as you know, the Asclepian symbol is the medical symbol with the two snakes, you know, around the helix of the the Caduceus, as it's called. But they would actually go there, and it was very ritualized when they went in. There would be high priests. They'd go in a huge room. They would do take baths in cold water, if you will, or, you know, sometimes there's definitely a ritual bathing process. And then they would have the hour of the lamps where the high priest would light lamps and say actual invocations for Asclepius or his daughters or some spirit that was associated with him to come during the dream and bring them the dream that they needed for healing. And then they would go in separate rooms called clines, which is the original Latin word that the word clinic later was derived from. But they would sleep there. And again, they would allow non-poisonous snakes to wander in, you know, freely because, and snakes, of course, are a symbol of healing. They become known as a really kind of a threatening symbol, a symbol of evil in the Western consciousness. But in the ancient world, they were probably one of the greatest symbols of healing and rebirth and regeneration associated with the ancient goddesses because when they slough their skin, they literally look like they're rebirthing themselves. So that's probably one reason why snakes were associated with the temples. But people would sleep in these and for several nights if necessary, you know, going through this ritual until, you know, the god or goddess came to them and told them what they needed to know and would heal them. And that was kind of basically the process of what went on. But it was a huge enterprise. I mean, there were a lot of temples, and people would come from all over, you know, to protect this particular kind of healing.
And there was probably some kind of group energy with people anticipating and with the intention of healing, and everyone together probably influenced each other.
I think you're absolutely right about that. I think you're absolutely right, which I didn't think about. Didn't incorporate, but that's a really good insight.
I'm just imagining, but so the idea would be so that's what he was saying, and you're kind of saying it wouldn't be a bad idea for us to revive this model in some form.
Well,
now
book, I think their concept of well, I really think a lot of people do it. They're all dream circles. They're dream groups, and if we don't go to the same place and dream, although some people go to Shark Cathedral, and there's different places where people get together for seminars and dream. I think that's the kind of model that's really good today. But I think you can even, just in your individual dreaming, there's a lot you can take from it. And I think the main thing is just the total complete belief that if, you know, I look for the sacred in my dream and I continue to do that, it will happen and it will heal me or help me at least to heal myself. I think is a really important thing for us to take away from this.
Yeah.
Well, you know, in the Western world, we just, you know, we're so secularized that not only are, you know, we tend to think of, you know, our personal waking, sleeping life being so different from, you know, where we get what we do spiritually or where we go to church, you know, that I think that that's what we need to put back together to be whole people, is that the sacred happens. It happens in my own psyche on a lot of different levels. And my dreams is one tremendous place where I can get in touch with that, and I can grow spiritually.
I like the way you put that. I like the way you put that together. Yeah. Well, I'm looking. Let's see. I want to. You know, there's so much I want to ask you about. Okay, I'm gonna have two things, and you tell me where you want to go. One is soul loss, and the idea that by analyzing dreams we can reclaim lost parts of ourselves. And the other direction would be, I don't know, if, just since we're starting to wind down on time, or do you want to talk about the, you know, like journaling and for the dreams?
Let me address the soul loss quickly.
Okay.
There's actually a Native American shaman by the name of Robert Moss, who writes about dreams a lot. And this part of the book I was actually quoting from him, but he has this philosophy that through our dreams, what happens through our dreams, especially when we go to places like houses we used to live or something, is that what happened at certain parts of our life or times in our life, we left part of our soul there, whether it be a relationship that ended there or something. And so he's saying that in our dreams, we can, when we go back to these places and find ourselves in places, especially that we associate with, you know, early parts of our lives, and especially places in which we dream about often, you know, that you can ask yourself while you're in this place, especially if you can lucidly dream, what did I leave here, and bring your soul back home as a means of emotional, you know, and spiritual and perhaps even physical self-healing. So that part of the book was really in tandem with what Robert Moss said about that, which I think is absolutely fascinating and very deep. So journaling, I would like to say a little more about dream journaling.
Sure, yeah.
And that is, yeah, is that, you know, after, and I want to back up even one more step and talk just briefly about dream recall. What do you do after you've had the dream, especially since a lot of people don't remember dreams, or a lot of times you wake up and you have you know you had a huge long dream, but you can only remember one little teeny part of it. So you can literally train yourself to remember your dreams by recalling them, by rehearsing them. As soon as you wake up, asking yourself, what was I dreaming? Because most people will wake up after a session of dreaming, after the long, deep REM sort of sleep. But a lot of times you don't remember it, especially if you go right back to sleep. So if you ask yourself what you were dreaming right as soon as you wake up, and if you can do it before you open your eyes, chances are you're going to really improve your chances of remembering. And then just put yourself back in the dream and think through it again until you can write it down. Okay, more can be said about dream recall. But then journaling dreams is really, really important. And as I said earlier, especially if you want to interpret them and see what's going on, writing down every detail you can remember. If you can remember long sequences of dream, the part that spoke to you the most profoundly, or the part that seemed the most sacred in this case, because we are talking about sacred dreams, do a very, very, very detailed description about that, especially looking for the symbols in it, which can be something like the color red. You know, something appeared that was red. Or, you know, a lot of things were red. Why was there so many things red in this dream? Two ways, after you, like, write down the narrative, which you can remember in detail, two things to really look for that are dead giveaways on what symbols are important is, first of all, ones that repeat themselves a lot, okay? Like saying, mm-hmm. A lot was red in my dream, or there were a lot of trees in my dream, or there were several different dogs in different places, whatever it is. Then things that seem weird or completely out of place, like just would totally not make sense in real life, or something you think, how did that come out of my brain, you know, in a dream?
Yeah.
Things like that, yeah. These are symbols that tell you something's going on, and these are the symbols that are probably encoded with what your deep consciousness is really, really trying to tell you. journaling will help you do that in a way that you cannot if you don't write it down. As you're writing down, things occur to you just as you're writing. What I do after I dream is I write my sick description, everything I can remember, then I go through on the facing page and I start pulling out the symbols that I think are significant, and then from there you can go into what I was talking about before, the process of unpacking those symbols for what associations, you know, that you have with them or you know, may have historically had with them and unpacking them for what's going on in the dream. But the journaling is really, really important. Journaling will help you take what's in your dream and then you think about it while you're journaling it. And again, this is another way to bridge the gap between your dreaming life and waking life. And then when you go back to dream again, you know, the contents of what you journaled, that means more to you. And also if you're going to creatively work with your dreams, as in writing or in art or dance or whatever expression, it's much easier to do if you've journaled it. That helps that continuum going where the dreams just keep getting more and more enriched and you start understanding more and more what's going on in them. And I want to give you one quick example if I have time.
Yes.
In the book I talk about how I was really, really working with journaling my dreams. Again, it takes time, I know that. But I went through a period where I was very, very diligently writing down my dreams, and I didn't even notice this until later on I went back and looked a month or two later at the dreams and started to see weird patterns. And three different dreams I had probably about within the same month, I was in a house. I didn't even think about when I was dreaming. All the houses were different in each dream, completely different, or so it seemed. A lot of what happened in the dream seemed completely different. But in journaling and paying really close attention, I started to realize that in every house, in every dream, at one point or another, in one different way or another, the front door was in a certain place, there was a window next to it, there was a kitchen I was aware of but didn't spend much time in a certain place. And when I started really going back and looking at these different houses, I realized these houses were laid out like the home that I grew up in. Okay, in every dream, at some point, I went over to a table where there was a light that was really bright on the table, and I was looking down at the table. And different things I could go on, but there was certain weird things that happened in every dream, even though it looked totally different in each dream, even though it was encoded, you know, differently. And what happened when I went back and really analyzed this is this dream was trying to tell me something really important about my work, you know, which I do on a table under a bright light, and my association with it, you know, and my emotions about it from my childhood, you know, and I could say more because it told me a lot more detail when I really analyzed it, but for the sake of illustrating how important dream journaling is, and then going back and reading it from time to time, you know, and patterns will start to emerge that can be just totally shocking, you know. And very informative.
It's interesting. It's sort of like, right, the more attention we give it and the more light we shine on it, it's like it feeds on itself and it grows and grows and grows. It's like, oh, you're interested, you know? And then just
starts to
reveal.
Yeah, and that's such a great way of articulating it. Yeah, that's such a great way of explaining that.
Thanks. Yeah, sure. And I just wanted to offer one thing, too, that I used to write down dreams, and then at some point if I'd wake up in the night or in the morning. And then at one point I realized that when I started writing, my dream would get away from me, you know, in a way, or maybe it was turning the lights on or something. So I actually have a little tape recorder next to my bed that's very small. And I just don't even have to turn on my light. And this is, I guess, just another thing I think if people want to think about. And I grab it and just push the buttons, you know, the little red light goes on, and I just speak my dream in detail in the dark, and then I turn it off, and then I transcribe it if it's an important dream. I don't do this for, I mean, quote unquote important dream, but if it's a notable dream to me, I guess I do that, and that way I feel like I get even more detail than when I write.
That's a great idea. Because sometimes it's just so hard to get up and turn on the light when you're
Yeah, so I can just stay in bed and just, you know, and just speak the dream and talk about how I feel and this and that in the dream. And so, if somebody doesn't mind, if you don't mind transcribing it later, I guess it's just one other thing to think about. But, you have given us a lot to percolate on. I feel like you've given us some really practical things we can do and think about, and then just ways to think about the sacred in dreaming. I definitely want to ask you, just because, as we've mentioned more than once, there is so much in your book, really. You cover a lot. But, I mean, is there anything, last thing in particular, that you'd like to make sure that you say or that you let us know about with regards to this?
Well, let me see. We did go over some of the things that are dearest to my heart. I would not mind saying a little bit more about one chapter in the book that we didn't touch on much, and that is, historically speaking, in sacred dreams, there are certain tendencies that are different in, like, women's dreams and men's dreams. And when I originally started writing this book, I was writing it about women's sacred dreams. And, of course, when the editor contacted me, I already had that book started. And of course, she wanted one that was more general. So I changed it. But historically, in dreams, what's really interesting is that most scriptures we have of the different world religions in sacred dreaming are, of course, written in patriarchal cultures, basically by men for a male audience. And so, but it's really interesting the way women are treated in these. First of all, women tend to have dreams that portend sacred births of a male heir. And you see that, like, in the case of Queen Maya in Buddhism before she had Siddhartha Gautama. And then Virgin Mary, the series of dreams that Joseph had before Jesus was born. And this is a pattern that you see really throughout a lot of religions. But in a lot of traditions, historically, in recorded things, women have been prophets of dreams. Women have been, it's like a women deities or sacred figures show up in dreams a lot. And women traditionally have been the ones who have been sought as far, by kings in different cultures throughout history, to interpret dreams. So it's kind of interesting how that plays out, and I just wanted to mention that because I think it's really interesting the way that
it is
culturally.
Mm-hmm. It is really interesting. Yeah. Was there anything else you wanted to say about that? We have just a couple minutes left, or
not about that particularly. I do want to say, and we touched on dream groups or seminars, and it's so great, if you can do like a weekend seminar, because as I said, it can be intense working with dreams. And as you mentioned, just the power, of being in community of all, people being in a place where you're dreaming and sharing. It's really an amazing thing. A lot of times people who get together and talk about dreams or get together once a month and talk about their dreams start training dreams. In other words, they will have the same dreams and show up, and there will be a lot of commonalities in their dreams. Mm. It's if you get people together to talk about their dreams, people can almost enter each other's dreams or their dream lives and interface through each other's dreams in a way that's just kind of magical, and I think kind of really shows the power of the dream beyond the confines of the individual psyche and the very transcendent nature of it. So that's kind of an interesting thing to keep in mind, that dreaming in a group or going to a seminar where people are all immersed in it and you have plenty of time to incubate your dreams, you have time to learn to navigate through your dreams, you have time to work together interpreting dreams, and even time, hopefully, to work creatively with your dreams and then take it back into the dream cycle. That can be a really powerful way to work, not only with dreams, but especially with sacred dreams.
Sacred dreams, yeah. And I think, and you mentioned Robert Moss earlier, and a friend of mine had introduced me a little bit to him some years ago, and I think you mentioned this in the book too, with in terms of group sacred dreaming. But I think people can also think about this if they share it, with a friend or family member. Is that the great If This Were My Dream. Maybe you just want to take a minute and introduce that for people who don't know that. I think that can really spark something in people as well.
A dream seminar that I did during my doctoral studies with very, very well-written dream psychologist Daniel Dallaire had us do this, and I read about it in several places, so it's fairly common practice. But when you're in a group, it's really fruitful if one person will share a dream, and in the way of trying to figure out what's going on in and under it, to go around a circle and have each person say, well, if this were my dream, you know, this might be how I would interpret it. Again, what this does is it kind of helps to get under what's going on in the symbolism of dreams, and it gives you other perspectives to look at what might be going on with it. And a lot of really interesting things can come out of that. So.
Yeah, I think so, and especially particularly with maybe a sacred dream, you know.
Right.
So, well, thank you so much. It's really been great. Yeah, it's so interesting. Yeah, and I just, you know, again, I want to mention the book and Dreaming, the Sacred Art, and, you know, there's many chapters. We didn't cover all the chapters by any means, but take a look
and
go deeper.
We should mention it's published by Skylight Paths Publishing. I think they would appreciate me saying that.
Oh, please, yes. Yes, and you can find it on Amazon and
Barnes and
Noble's. Great. And people can find out more about you and your work and your upcoming work at
www.lauriswick.com.
Yes. Okay. Well, thanks again. And thanks, everyone, for joining us. And have a great day.
Thank you, Lana.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.